And good morning once again, and welcome to the other side of midnight. That magical time between dusk and dawn where the things we look at in daytime and we kind of casually dismiss, if we look at them again after sunset, as the earth rotates around to see the stars, maybe they take on a little different light, as I think the topic of conversation this morning is going to take on a little different light. I'll introduce my guest momentarily, but I have a couple of things I want to do at the top of the show, and one of them, actually a couple of them, are extremely relevant to things that are going to be happening in the latter part of this week. So let me start out. This is the anniversary, of course, of Martin Luther King. It was an amazing journey from my own childhood to now to look at how this culture, this civilization that we're a part, has become better. In my lifetime, it has become better. And one of the ways that it's become better is connected to link number one on our Radio with Pictures page tonight. If you go to othersideofmidnight.com and you click on Radio with Pictures in the upper right-hand corner, that will take you to tonight's guest page. And at the very top, link number one is a clip from Nichelle Nichols talking about the rather remarkable day that Martin Luther King told her personally, in a personal meeting, that she could not quit Star Trek. That, in fact, the character that Jean had limbed out and the role that she was playing in terms of millions of minds and young consciousness looking at a black role model on NBC, network television, starring in a remarkable futuristic show which depicted everyone and everything appreciated for who and what they are. What an amazing idea in the 1960s from my friend Gene Roddenberry. Anyway, Martin Luther King, when Nichelle's role had been relegated to a more minor role in, I think, the transition between the first and second and third seasons, particularly first and second, she was considering basically quitting. In fact, I think she wrote a letter. Anyway, she describes in this video clip what happened and how Martin Luther King personally convinced her that her role in Star Trek, depicting a black woman on the bridge of a starship, giving commands on occasion, was an important thing that she simply could not put down, and she didn't, and the rest, as they say, is history. Unfortunately, there's some other history we have to refer to this morning. Glenn Frey, the co-creator of the Eagles, has died at 67. Link number two will take you to a page which is an appropriate accolade for the most amazing talent. It's really a shame that we seem to have more and more talent leaving us. It's really too bad because, as I've said on this show previously, and I will say again and again, one of the key reasons that we're alive and that we experience this life is to experience the arts and the culture and the science and the things that make life worth living. Life is more than plumbing. And when people like David Bowie and Nat King Cole's daughter and Glenn Frey leave us, we are poorer. Another thing I want you to take a note of on Radio with Pictures tonight is item number three. If you go to item number three, click on the link. That is an amazing video showing that Elon Musk almost came within a whisker of achieving the return of the first stage of the Falcon 9 rocket to a floating barge, a platform, at sea, almost 200 miles south of the Vanguard Air Force Base where the mission was launched from on Sunday afternoon, our time. Anyway, if you take a look at the video, you'll see that what happened is that the spacecraft came down, the rocket came down and landed like a feather. Even though if you watch the horizon, the barge was pitching up as the rocket was coming down, all this. So it wasn't the hard landing, but what apparently has happened, as you look at the video, is that one of the struts, one of the landing legs, collapsed. And Musk himself tweeted tweeted that it was probably due to ice having been jammed into the mechanism when the landing legs come down just before landing. The command is sent from the computer, and the landing legs splay outwards and lock into place. Well, one of the legs did not lock because apparently, because of the heavy fog at Vandenberg during the launch, and then the water on the rocket taken to altitude, it froze, and it froze into the locking mechanism, and so when the landing legs deployed, the locking mechanism did not lock, and that one leg was not what it should have been, and the rocket gently and majestically tipped over on the platform, and you can see it as it does all that. Anyway, the point that's important, though, is that all you have to do is add a heater, like the NASA had to do with the shuttle after the Challenger issues, and they would have been fine. So it looks like the next one they're going to try. Everything about the landing on the barge seemed to work extraordinarily well. So let us look forward to the next successful flight and the accomplishment of all the objectives. Okay, my guest this morning is a kind of a, in keeping with some of the other things we've done at the beginning of this year, 2016. We've looked at hyperdimensional torsion field physics as it applies to psychic activities, precognition, things like that. We've looked at it in terms of foretelling the future, what's going to happen in this coming year. We've looked at it in terms of energy production. Are there ways to tap into the ether, i.e. the torsion field, and release unlimited and environmentally safe energy? Well, this morning we're going to be talking about the torsion field and something which I'm very, very intrigued with, which is the concept of healing. How does one human being approaching another human being through words and hands and gestures and creating an environment, how is that individual able to affect the actual biological, biochemical, biophysical process of that other human being? What mechanisms? Are they electromagnetic, as most everybody seems to think? Or are they something more interesting? Are they something beyond? Are they something more? Well, this morning with my guest, Peter Bedyard, we're going to explore the idea of healing. If you read the blurb that we published at the bottom of the guest page this morning, you'll see that Peter had some major personal illnesses in his life. We're probably going to talk about those in some length. And from those personal experiences developed a capacity to reach out and to heal others. Peter's been working to develop this power into a series of holistic therapies. It's with this understanding that he's created a thriving one-on-one private practice, workshops and talks. Peter teaches around the world. He has an online healing tea store called Create Your Health Teas, healing herbs and spices. And I guess the best way to do this is to welcome Peter to the program and ask you right off the bat, Peter, what happened that changed your life so that you became a different person?
Well, that it's a conglomeration of events.
Okay.
The real trigger was quite a few years ago, you know, and this was a whole process of stumbling. I was killed. Somebody drove me into the back of a semi-truck.
What? So, what? Someone murdered you?
Somebody killed me. Yeah, they drove me into the back of a semi-truck. They came up behind me when I was on my moped. I had a moto became bike, sort of a think of it like a bicycle, and it was motorized, and somebody came up behind me and pushed my back tire and pushed me into a parked semi-truck.
Oh, my God.
And I had an experience where I watched my body impact the truck, and I saw my body bounce out into the street, and eventually I just left this plane and went somewhere else. I don't know where that was, but it was on the other side, as is often referred to, and I had that experience of being told that I couldn't stay there. I felt that I had gotten kicked out of heaven.
So you had the record of having arrived and been kicked out almost immediately.
Yes, and it was a very disturbing thing because upon my dying, I was filled with just amazing joy. It was very jarring to go from that experience of being on the bike and being in fear, and then suddenly being in this experience of absolute bliss.
And how old were you?
I was just a kid. I was almost 18. I was almost 18 years old.
So you hadn't lived anything yet, and suddenly there you are being pushed into a semi and you're dying.
Yeah, yeah.
And, okay, and, what? Obviously the next question is, what happened next?
Well, so that's part of, you know, there's a whole thing. So that triggered a whole series of events in my life upon coming back. But
Wait. Don't skip over. How did you come? What happened next? Did the ambulances arrive? Are you having an out of body? Are you looking down on yourself? Are you
sure? So I'll give you the whole experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So initially, what happened was everything happens very quickly in these types of situations, and your mind can go extremely fast and have lots of understandings in just seconds. And before the impact of my hitting the semi-truck, I was thinking, there's this car behind me, what do I do? And I came up with three solutions of, do I lay the bike down? Do I see if I could just hope and pray to fit between the car and the semi-truck that they were going to give me the room? Do I go around it somehow and try to jump the curb and go up on the sidewalk? Is there even time for those things? And there wasn't time. There wasn't time for any of those things.
But you had time for all that, and then you looked at this inevitability, and it's getting closer and closer, and you say, this is it.
Exactly. Yeah, I had enough time to sort of, you know, the mind and thought works far more faster than the physical world. So I had enough time in those seconds to think about possibilities, but not enough time to actually physically get a solution into my. I punished myself for a long time because of that. After coming back, I really would beat myself up about, why didn't I make a different decision? Why didn't I do something? Why did I let this happen? That type of thing.
Right.
And it really took me some really deep work to understand that when I really looked at that experience in real time, in this physical world that we live in this time, there wasn't space. There wasn't even a possibility for me to be able to assess a situation, a choice. Go ahead.
Would you call that a variation of a survivor's guilt? You couldn't believe that you'd survived?
Yeah, absolutely. Most certainly. I felt like I did something wrong. I should have been better. I should have made a better decision.
Okay, so let's go back to the accident. You're being pushed into the truck. You're dying, or you died.
So I get pushed into the truck. I actually jump out of my body right before the impact, and so suddenly I'm standing on the side of the road and watching my body and my bike hit the semi truck.
That must have been weird.
It was very weird, and it was something that I couldn't consciously recall for quite a while. I had really blocked that out, which also contributed to that guilt of, why didn't I do something? Why didn't I understand the situation better?
Right.
And those memories only came back after I did some really, really deep body work, and the blacked out consciousness was able to be recalled. So that was super, super cool to be able to understand, wait, I didn't have the time to make those choices. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have to beat myself up anymore about it, which was great to have that recollection, that memory. But I jumped out of my body. I saw my body hit the truck, and the car drove away. My body bounced out into the middle of the street. My bike folded into itself. And luckily, I had a helmet on, and I was able to basically live. The helmet saved my life. So I floated above the scene. I kind of went up into the air above the semi-truck, and I got to see the neighborhood in which this happened. It was a little suburban neighborhood. I was driving in from a downtown area into my little suburban house area. There weren't a lot of people. It was sometime after 10 o'clock at night,
And my body was just sort of lying there out in the middle of the road. And I was very aware that I had left my body. I was very aware that my body was in a lot of pain and that I wasn't. And I was very aware that the experience that who I was no longer possible in that moment.
So wait. I'm a little confused. All right, you're looking down at yourself. you're having an out of body experience.
Mm-hmm.
You just said that your body's in pain. If you've died, if you've been killed, why is your body in pain? In other words,
so I was aware that my body was really messed up. That my body was in really bad shape.
Okay.
And I was aware that I wasn't feeling that pain.
I see. Okay.
And so I was very aware that who I was in that moment in time could no longer exist. As a kid, I was a scholarship student as a dancer. So I was a real athlete, and I was very strong. I was very sinewy, and I was very quick at learning. I went from being a novice to being a teacher's assistant as a dancer really quickly. I was very gifted in that experience. My body had that type. Like if I would have been in the USSR at the time, the Soviet Union was still around, I would have probably been recruited to go into the dance training programs there because they had the physicality of that, you know, the bone placement, that type of stuff that they look for in like the Bolshoi and different things. And so I was very aware.
So you might have wound up with the Bolshoi.
Well, yeah, who knows? If I would have been Russian, sure. that experience that I've been having, that my life as this dancer was over. That was no longer a possibility.
So you're a kid, 18, you want to be a dancer, you're riding on your bike, somebody slams you into a truck, you die, you watch all this, but you don't remember at the time that you're watching all this. It's only later, after you have been resurrected, that you... How much later did you kind of realize what experience you'd gone through? Because apparently in the hospital, what, you just woke up?
Sort of. So I remember the entire experience except for the moment of impact.
Okay.
The moment of impact and that experience of and how I had to fill in the blanks for those couple seconds of why didn't I make a better choice.
Okay.
That part I was able to recall after doing some deep muscle tissue work much later, about 15 years later. And I didn't talk about any of this experience, even though I was very aware of it. I didn't talk about it because it was so out of my family's and my own personal understanding of the world. You know, that type of thing, it just wasn't discussed. My dad was Catholic, my mom was Episcopalian, and life after death was not, and you know, coming back after death was not something that was even a concept of discussion or a possibility that as I knew it in my family.
Okay.
So I kept most of this a secret. So anyway, I was floating above my body, above the whole scene, and the next thing I knew, I was going down this tunnel. And I always, you know, you always try to understand situations or explain situations through what you already know. And so for people who are my age or older, if you were ever a fan of the $6 Million Man.
Ah, yes, of course.
So when I don't know if you remember, there was a series, and the tunnel, I believe, is still there over at Universal Studios. There's the ice tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
Going in that tunnel, when the tram goes in the tunnel is spinning. So the tunnel spins in a clockwise fashion as the tram is driving through it, or in the movie, in the TV show, the $6 Million Man was running through the tunnel. And that was my experience. I was going through this tunnel. As I was going through the tunnel, I was shooting through this experience, but the tunnel was also corkscrewing, sort of spinning around me.
Now, wait, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that this is what happened, or this is your interpretation based on your memory of a TV show of what happened?
No, this is what happened, okay. And the only way I can explain it where people...
Oh, you were relating it. Okay, so it was very similar to that opening of the $6 Million Man.
Sure.
Interesting. Okay, so...
So then I find myself on the other side, and I'm in this place, and it's a very interesting place where I don't
So your body's in the hospital, but you're not there. You're somewhere else.
No, my body never, my body still at this point has not made it to the hospital. I'm just lying. My body is lying in the middle of the road.
Oh, my God. For how long did it lie there?
We don't know. There's no police report and no ambulance report. And so, yeah, there's no idea. So it could, in my perspective, but, you know, time is very strange in these moments. It could have been a very long time. I don't know how I was found. I don't know who called me in. I don't know how the ambulance was reported. I do know that ambulance times were at least 6 minutes around.
Okay.
Period, for sure, that I was lying there in the street. Because and I'll get to when I came back into my body.
Okay.
So on the other side, I was in this space where I was very aware that there I could stand, but I couldn't really make out a floor as we know a floor. There, it just seemed like vast a possibility. Just this, just vastness, this soaring space.
I mean, is it hitting you? I've just watched myself die. Or actually, you didn't remember that part. You had this blank, and then you're floating around. Obviously, it's not normal. So, what did you think had happened? Did you think you were having a classical near-death experience or after-death experience? Or
at the time, I wasn't really judging it. But just to clarify again, I was very aware that I was dead. I was very aware of all of that. I just wasn't aware of the part that I couldn't remember was the moment where my body impacted the truck.
Do you think that was for your own protection?
I do. I think it was too much for me to be able to process, that I had to let my...
So some agency removed your consciousness from that horrific moment. Otherwise, you may have really died. You may have been permanently trapped or something.
Sure, there's definitely an experience, a mechanism that's within us that we can't handle as the trauma of a situation. We black it out.
Okay.
Until we can actually be able to contain that knowledge, that information.
So you know you're dead. You know you're not in the hospital. You know your body's lying there. What goes on next?
And I'm on the other side. I'm in this space that I'm aware that it feels like there is a definition to it, but it doesn't. There's nothing in the traditional manners. Like, I'm aware that I could stand, but I can't necessarily make out a floor. And the same with the ceiling. I'm aware that I'm in a space, but it seems like a space full of infinity.
Hmm.
And I'm in this space. I'm very curious. And
is there anyone with you?
Not yet. I'm as happy as I possibly can be. There's this joy, this bliss. And I really like people to get that message that death is this amazing, beautiful, blissful, joyous experience. And there's nothing to be afraid of. It was just probably one of the most happiest experiences of my entire life.
Were you familiar with any of the other people that have had this experience at 18 when you had this?
Not at all.
Okay, so this is totally new to you. You haven't read anything, any TV shows, etc.?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I'm sure, you know, it's such a part of pop culture that
that's what I'm thinking. Yeah,
there might have been some sort of reference to it, but it was nothing that ever was a curiosity to me, and it was nothing that I ever really consciously read about or looked at. I'm sure I had heard about people dying and coming back, but I don't think I'd ever heard of the actual experience of that, except for, you know, somebody was in the hospital, they flatlined, and then they came back.
Okay, so you're aware of a body, you're aware of directionality up and down, but you feel that you're kind of floating in the middle of infinity.
Yeah, and it's the happiest experience that I could possibly describe.
Wow.
And there's this sense of, wow, this is really amazing, I like this place. Now, right before my accident, when I was on that bike, I was extremely angry.
Oh.
And that's something that I bring in later. But
so that's why you felt the guilt, because you felt you yourself had contributed to your death.
No, sort of. That's an understanding of the anger wasn't about my death, though. I was.
No, I'm saying that because you were angry, you were distracted, and things just got out of hand.
Sure. That's certainly a definite possibility. I'm open to that. I was angry because I wasn't allowed to do something. My parents had restricted me in doing something that I wanted to do. And I felt that I was almost 18, just a few weeks away. I should be able to do what I want to do. But they said no, and so I obeyed their
rule. You went and got on your bike, and you went out to have a really fast ride, and something happened.
Not at all. I was actually working, and okay. I was... I was wanted to go to an event that was after the show that I was in, like a cast party type of thing after the show. And my parents said that I couldn't do that because they were concerned with you know, me being a minor and being out with these people that were older than me.
So in this new space, this anger, of course, is completely gone now. And you say you feel better than you've ever, ever, ever felt. Then what happens?
And I'm just curious and exploring the space. And I'm wondering why people aren't here, because I had heard that when you die, there's supposed to be people on the other side. You're supposed to meet your great-grandmother, your ancestors, you know, those types of things. And they weren't there. So I was very curious about that. And it wasn't like it was a judgment about it, but there was a definite.
It was an expectation from your popular culture thing, and
exactly.
Okay.
And then all of a sudden there was this there was another person there, and he just sort of materialized, and I felt this incredible love for this person, this man that showed up. That I had no idea who he was, so it was kind of like the way I try to explain it is. Kind of like when you're in a dream and you're having this dream experience and you're having this, there's somebody in your dream and maybe it's a friend, a spouse, a loved one, whatever it is, but you have this experience that you know them and yet you can't place who they are. So that was this experience was this man appears. He is wearing a tweed suit that looked like sort of English tailoring from Hong Kong.
Oh my God.
The British. And I'm curious. I'm like, who are you? And my heart feels like it's ripping. And this just excitement that there's this person there. And at the same time, my consciousness is curious because I'm thinking, I don't know who you are, but wow. And it was a very strange experience. And he shows up again, my pop culture way of explaining this to people is to say he looked like Obi-Wan Kenobi when Obi-Wan.
That's amazing.
He didn't specifically look like Obi-Wan Kenobi, but the idea of that projection where when, you know, R2-D2 is showing the message of Obi-Wan Kenobi and it's like this.
Are you wondering why these things that are showing up are looking so familiar?
No, and again, this is just, they're not in the moment in time.
So it's only afterwards in reflection.
I'm just trying to give people a vision of what it looked like for me.
I'll tell you what, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. Hey. My guest this morning is Peter Bedard. I believe that's how Peter pronounces his name. We're going to talk about healing, but first we have to get through Peter's death and the discovery that he had amazing gifts, and we're going to find out if the gifts came from the experience. You're on the other side of midnight on a chilly Land of Enchantment morning. Tuesday morning. Yes, it's Tuesday. Anyway, my name's Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. We are back on the other side of midnight with my guest this morning, Peter Bedard. Before we continue, I did want to make one mention at the top of the show, which completely blew my mind until M gently reminded me. Robin and I would like to thank Linda Moulton Howe and acknowledge with great appreciation her winning of the LA Expo Award. Linda has been appearing at the Conscious Life Expo for many, many, many years, and this year they apparently are giving her a lifetime achievement, which is overdue. Anyway, I just wanted to remind everyone that if you're following what takes place at the Conscious Life Expo, that's one of the things that's going to be taking place. Anyway, Peter, we were in the middle of you describing your meeting with God?
Right, yeah.
In a tweed coat looking like, who was he looking like?
Well, he shows up as the sort of a Fu Manchu type of character, wearing a tweed suit from like British Hong Kong, but he's sort of projected. His presence is kind of like a holographic kind of vision.
I mean, this was such an overwhelming experience to change your entire life. I think we should kind of try to get into taking parts of it apart, because if you didn't meet God, who did you meet, and how did you get these abilities, or how were they brought out through this meeting?
Sure. So, and they weren't necessarily brought out through this meeting. The healing work that I do came through my having to heal the anger, the resentment of feeling like I was kicked out of heaven, as well as all of the actual physical things that went wrong with me once I was put back into this body.
So,
process.
Okay. Well, but it was because of these events. Without those events, nothing that you're going to describe would have happened. So please continue.
Sure. So I'm on the other side. There's this gentleman shows up. I have no idea who he is. I feel this tremendous love for him. He is somebody that I would never recommend or recognize. My lineage is French Caucasian, so I have no idea who this person is that shows up, but I have this just overwhelming joy at seeing him. He looks at me in a very confused way. And I respond. I don't know exactly what I respond.
Wait a minute. Your Skype cut out at that point. He looks at you in a confused way, and then?
And he says, "What are you doing here?"
And you said, "Wait a minute, aren't you God? Don't you know what I'm doing here?"
Right, exactly. That was my understanding. That was sort of the message that I sent to him. And then his next statement to me was, "You need to go back.
Oh,
you're not supposed to be here." And with that, I got extremely angry. All that anger that I had been feeling prior to the accident just flooded back into me, and I was no longer in that place anymore. I was back here on this dimension, in this space.
Wait. You mean because you got angry, you suddenly returned to your body?
I don't know if it was a combination of this person, this entity, whatever he was, saying, "You're not supposed to be here," and then saying, "Go, okay, go, time to go," and or my anger that brought me back here. I don't know which one. It could have been a combination of the two. Mm-hmm. But suddenly I'm back. I'm not in my body. I'm back sort of hovering above the street.
Oh.
And I see the ambulance come up. And so that's why I'm saying I have no idea how long I was in that state. Because I'm still not back in my body. The ambulance is coming in. Several minutes must have passed. The guys run up. There's two EMTs. One of them is an African-American man, and he puts his face really close to mine. I'm guessing that he's looking for vitals.
Right.
And he's, you know, trying to hear my breath. And the next thing I know is I'm actually in my body, opening my eyes, and I scare the crap out of him. And he literally jumps, and I say, "Take me!" I say, "My medical card's in my wallet," and then I jump out of my body again.
Oh,
and so I watch them.
Do you know whether this has ever happened? Because the only stories I've ever heard is people are out of their body, they come back in, and that's it. I've never heard of leaving and returning and leaving and returning. This is pretty intriguing.
Yeah, I have not heard of that type of thing before. Normally, you're in and you're out.
It seems to me you were very, very, very conflicted, and you did not want to be in your body.
I didn't want to come back. I absolutely didn't want to come back. Why would I want to leave the most amazing, blissful joy that I ever experienced? I was pissed. So I was now doubly pissed, because I was very angry when the accident happened. And now I feel like I got kicked out of heaven. And so I'm angry at that. And I was as a kid, I never felt like I fit in. And why the dance issue or the experience was so important to me is because dance was the only place I ever felt at home in my life experience. And so growing up, I didn't necessarily feel like I fit into my family. I didn't feel like I fit into my community or the culture around me. And dance was the only way that I felt like I had some sense of being accepted and fitting in. And I knew that that wasn't possible anymore because of what my body looked like out there on the street.
Oh.
And so...
You had one hell of a set of blows all in rapid succession.
Oh, yeah. And it just got worse as time went on. So I jumped out of my body. I watched them put my body in the ambulance. I watched them close the doors of the ambulance, and I watched them drive away. And I'm literally very conscious of thinking to myself, I'm not going back in there. And so I don't want to be in that body at all. I'm very aware of why. And the next memory that I have is opening my eyes in the hospital. So I'm back in my body. My parents are there. And I'm in a lot of pain. I'm actually numb from that whole experience.
Hmm. Now, in retrospect, you've obviously done a lot of thinking about this, a lot of thinking. Have you come to any conclusion as to why you weren't allowed to stay? And no matter what you did, I mean, you apparently really, really, really did not want to be here, and here you are. So have you figured out yet the bigger parameters, what determined where you wound up and what you wound up doing?
Absolutely. So I've come to understand that it just wasn't my time. And second, there were things that I still needed to achieve, things I still needed to ready for me. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because, you know, my going through all the series of things that happened to me after this accident, I often contemplated suicide. And I couldn't, I talked myself out of committing suicide because my understanding was, well, if I got kicked out of heaven,
there's no way you can stay.
How am I going to get back in? And the other alternative, as far as what I know, wasn't such a great choice.
the floors, the elevators that go down.
Exactly.
And down and down. Okay, so, all right. So, all right. This is important to set up how it is you can do what you do. You said a moment ago that because of all the problems of reintegrating into that body, which obviously was in pretty smashed up condition, you had terrible problems, and it was the problems that created what you have now done with your life.
Exactly, and that's a big message that I really like to get out to people, that that pain is actually something to embrace. And that pain is your greatest teacher. And pain will call you to live your highest potential. So you could either live in the experience of the pain and get caught up in that experience of the pain, or you can evolve and integrate that pain and hear the calling that the pain is bringing you towards.
Okay, so let's go through what the doctor said was wrong so we can get some approximation of the pain that you were in. You must have been in really bad shape.
I was in very bad shape. So I shattered my left knee, and I shattered it from the back. My knee had doubled onto itself.
Oh. So
my kneecap was in perfectly fine condition. But the whole part of my leg from about 5 inches up and 5 inches down from the kneecap had shattered into little tiny pieces.
Oh, my gosh.
So my kneecap, my knee was shattered. I split my right wrist open, and I'm right-hand dominant. So my wrist split open, and I lost all the nerves in my right hand. I cracked 5 vertebrae, and I had undiagnosed brain damage. And these experiences that I had to heal from just sort of kept getting worse and worse and worse. I called it the sort of cascade. When one thing started to go wrong and it wasn't healed.
So you're in the hospital. Doctors are treating you. You're in emergency care. They're trying all kinds of things, and it's not working.
Well, what they do is they just bundle me up, and they send me home because they know that they need to do surgery, and they can't do it because I'm in too much trauma. And the skin has been so busted up that they needed to heal a little bit more. So I come back 2 weeks later, and I go into surgery. They put a bunch of pins in my leg and actually glue the little bone fragments back to each other. It was a very advanced surgery for the time.
Oh, my gosh, like an archaeological reconstruction.
Yeah, actually, in a way, which is why the $6 million man that always makes me...
Very apt, very apt. Yes, I can see why.
So they put me back together. But then this cascade effect of things start to happen, and I'm in chronic pain. I have to learn how to walk again. That chronic pain lasts for a good 20 years.
Oh, my God, Peter.
I have one leg longer than the other. I develop hip issues. I develop sciatica issues. I have anxiety. I have depression issues. I develop bronchitis and asthma and fibromyalgia and arthritis. The list just goes, sort of goes on and on and on. At one time, my hemoglobin was splitting. Another time, my white blood cells were attacking my red blood cells. I have four close-to-death experiences where I dehydrate so severely that I'm hospitalized, and I just have this sort of cascade of 20 years of constant pain. And all that's offered to me, you know, Western medicine was fantastic about putting me back together, but as far as quality of life and dealing with all of these other issues, the only thing they had to offer me was drugs and surgery. Hmm. I'd already been there, and so I basically just lived in pain for a long time. I was in so much pain that I actually disconnected from my body. I was out at a convention at one point. I was meeting a friend at a restaurant afterwards, and I was waiting for him. I was in the bar lobby sort of area, and somebody came up to me and asked me if I was all right. And I gave him this very odd look, like, why is a stranger coming up to me and asking me if I'm okay? And he says, because you're crying.
Oh.
And I didn't even recognize that I was crying. My body was in so much pain, and I had disconnected from my body so much that I wasn't even aware of it.
So what was the turning point? What happened?
So eventually I had a sciatica experience where I could only get out of bed on my hands, on my back. So I had to crawl like a crab, not like a baby on the front, but on the back area.
Mm.
And somebody had said to go try this chiropractor or this acupuncturist, and my doctor was talking potential surgery, that they don't know what's wrong with me, but they could go look. And I didn't want to have exploratory surgery, and I crawled into an acupuncturist's office and walked out. And I said, there's something to this. This is pretty amazing. I walked out. I wasn't pain-free, but I was able to move. And my pain level had dropped significantly.
And this was just from classical acupuncture points, someone who knew what they were doing, vibrating the needles, whatever.
Yeah, and it was amazing. Now, this was a good, probably, how old was I? Probably 15 years after the accident.
My. Why did it take you so long to go for acupuncture?
I didn't even know anything about it. I didn't know. You know, this was back in the mid and early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And my world wasn't aware of that type of stuff. I heard of acupuncture, but I didn't really know what it was about. I didn't know that it could help me.
But having died and come back, weren't you curious to look beyond the edge of the paper? Didn't you, with that experience, didn't you basically say, wait a minute, everything I think I know, I don't?
Not at all, because I was so stuck. I felt so that the experience that I hadn't even really started talking about it by that point. It was so out of the box and so uncomfortable for me, and something that I didn't want to really recognize, because why would I want to tell anybody that I got kicked out of heaven? So,
okay.
So no. I didn't understand any of that stuff. And now I'm only a kid. I'm only in my late 20s, maybe early 30s by this point. And I've been in survival mode now for quite a long time.
Right.
And I don't have very much money. So I'm living paycheck to paycheck. I'm barely paying my rent. And now I'm supposed to go and pay a couple hundred bucks to go see a energy healer.
An acupuncturist, okay.
An acupuncturist or anything.
Right.
You know, those types of things were so out of my realm of understanding and even possibility that I was told the only way to heal was drugs and surgery. But those things I had rejected, but I didn't have anything else to turn to.
Mm.
So when this experience of the acupuncturist came in, it was mind-blowing.
Wow.
Just wow, okay, there are things that I could do in the world where I don't have to take a drug that's, you know, may help me or just mask the pain, and I don't have to go in for another surgery. I have options now.
That must have been an amazing insight.
It was huge. And I started just experimenting with everything I possibly could. I'm still very poor at this time, but I'm taking any extra money that I have for quite a few years and putting it into everything. I just became my own guinea pig, and I started exploring acupuncture and chiropractic and deep tissue massage and iridology and ear coning and anything that I could possibly find that might help me be able to either manage the pain or heal all these issues that are going on with me. And I've been able to grow my cartilage back and get rid of the pain and even out my legs, and like one was shorter than the other because of the accident. Now they're both equal. I was able to do all of these things through holistic therapies.
Wow.
And at one point, I just decided that as I was learning and growing and learning and growing, I decided to go back and get a master's program. So I got a master's degree in a combination field. It's a science and religion field. So it's basically quantum theory and cosmology and stuff sort combined with theology. So I'm getting this degree as master's. And at the same time, I find another exciting thing to learn about, and that's hypnotherapy. And so I go back to school and I start doing these things, and at the same time I'm also experimenting with all these holistic therapies, and I start healing myself. And so I'm going through these processes and I start to understand, hey, when we are in pain, as I was, that pain exists on so many different levels. There's at least the physical, the intellectual thought level, and then the heart spirit level. And when I started doing work on each of those levels, I was inspired to do that by the cocktail that was coming out in the late 90s, where they were using a drug cocktail to treat cancer and HIV. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, what would a holistic cocktail be like? And so I started to, instead of doing one therapy at a time when I could afford it, I started to combine therapies. And that really made my healing just skyrocket.
So you found there was a synergistic effect of combining different modalities. Like, give us an example of things you would combine.
So I would do, say, acupuncture with chiropractic with meditation and mindfulness work, and then throw in some sort of disciplining of the brain, or even playful type of things, such as running in the grass or sitting on the beach or something of that sort, where one would address my spirit, another would address my thinking, and another would address the physical. That even evolved, and I started developing a relationship with my pain, because we always have a relationship, but most of the time it's an unconscious. Or if it is a conscious relationship, it's one of animosity.
Sure.
My dialogue with my pain was, I hate you. I wish you'd go away. I can't stand you. I'm embarrassed of you. I'm ashamed of you. And I would want to kick it and do whatever I can, drug it, whatever I could to get it to get out of me. And I wasn't understanding that the pain was actually a very important part of me. And I started to redefine that relationship with the pain. Instead of making it wrong or bad, I recognize that when I feel loved, it's so much easier for me to heal. It's so much easier for me to work. So, and of having that animosity-based relationship with my pain, I started to turn that around. It's hard to do at first. It's hard to love the thing that is killing you. And I redefined that relationship and made it my best friend. And in loving the pain and in loving this part of me that was hurting, I also started to then develop a dialogue with it, and a conscious dialogue instead of that subconscious dialogue of just being angry and frustrated with it. Dialogue is two-way. And so I started to love the pain, give it that love, send it that experience, and then see what it would say back to me. And that's what I do with a lot of my clients. So I ask them to actually redefine this relationship. I ask them to now take the learnings that I have and to incorporate them into their own life. And to Rumi, one of my favorite poets, says the cure for the pain is in the pain. Mm. And that was very inspirational to me.
Okay. So you said a moment ago that you'd actually been able to heal some of these of severe problems that had been caused by the accident. Yeah. Like, give us some examples, because people obviously are listening, and there are people listening tonight who are in pain. That's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, because in the next hour we're going to talk about how your practice has turned into how you can help people alleviate and remove and get with and get beside their own pain. But I wanted to get back to, what did you do to yourself that you actually saw making a difference?
Sure. So that first big step was really redefining. Instead of, I try to explain it by saying, so what, Richard, what if you were the symbol or the personification of my pain? Now, you're deeply connected to me. Wherever I go, you go. You are part of me. And if I spoke it to you the way that I spoke to my pain, which was saying something like, I hate you, I wish you'd go away, I'm embarrassed of you, I'm ashamed of you, that type of thing, would you, as this personification of my pain, want to help me heal?
Oh.
And so I had to start speaking to you differently. And so that's what the listeners, one of the first
things. Now, where did you get the insight? I mean, did God tell you this, or did... At what point did you realize that you had to become your pain's best friend in order to get it behind you?
Well, it was certainly a long process. And so it was an eventual type of thing. When I started to explore the hypnotherapy, I came in contact with Martin, David Bressler and Martin Rossman over at the UCLA Pain Clinic. Okay. They were a couple of my teachers in my master's program. And they started having this thing where they would dialogue with the pain. Now, they would just sort of dialogue with it. I took that to, well, what if instead of just talking at it, what if I actually took that further and I actually became willing to even love it? Because that was my understanding of when we feel loved, it's so much easier to heal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took that work that they had, that sort of concept, to a different level of actually, what if I actually became...
So they were talking dialogue and you were talking, well, if you're going to dialogue with something that is a part of you, why not embrace it as part of you? And that's what you worked on.
Exactly. Because like there were studies in the 70s about cancer. And so where they would do studies about people visualizing, imagining, and thinking about blowing up the cancer and, you know, bombing it or cutting it out or having that sort of imagery.
Visualization.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought, well, that's interesting, and that's not a bad thing, but it's very violent and aggressive, and why would I want to do something violent to myself?
Hmm.
And so that's when I started just adding that element of love. And I noticed that when I started treating my pain, so again, if you're that personification of my pain, and I said, Richard, I know you're hurting, and you know what? I'm sorry about that. And I'm willing to even love you and to give you that love. And maybe there would be an imagery or visualization thing about, you know, giving you that word love, or making giving you a hug or some sort of connection with that where you could feel that love. And when I started to do that, my pain calmed down. And at times it even went away.
Hmm.
And so I thought, there's something really powerful here. And what if I started combining this with all those other holistic therapies that I've embarked on?
So did you have the idea that you were hypnotizing yourself, or that you were actually having a dialogue with a part of yourself that was causing pain? In other words, it sounds to me like there's a whole bunch of stuff going on simultaneously. Did I lose you?
Yeah, yeah. It's all happening at the same time. But sometimes it was more of the dialogue. Good. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you lose me?
No. You're back, but you're really breaking up badly. What we might try to do at the top of the hour is to reinitialize your connection, because this is not a good connection. Go ahead.
All right. Yeah. Well, okay. So yes, it was a whole combination of stuff where the hypnosis work I eventually started to bring into my practice too, because I thought, well, what if, hypnosis is basically guided imagery. Hypnosis is sort of a meditative state in which you actually become active instead of passive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started bringing that into the whole process as well. And that's this sort of 10-point process that I do, and which is what's really in my book. And if anybody gets my book, in the back of the book, there's a cheat sheet. So people can do this stuff on their own, so they can ask the questions and follow along in the process on their own as well.
I believe we have a link to your book in your bio, which is, of course, on your guest page tonight. Go to othersideofmidnight.com. Upper right-hand corner, click on Radio with Pictures. That will take you to your page. And your book is listed there, Convergence Healing. How did you come up with the idea of convergence healing? What is convergence healing? I mean, convergences sound to me like a bunch of stuff coming together. Am I on the...
You're exactly right. It's a bunch of things coming together. And that's what started happening in my life. And that's what I really work with my clients. So I started to have that understanding of what if I started to redefine my relationship with the pain and actually love it.
But the pain was caused by actual medical problems. I mean, apparently the doctors say that all the stuff that you had going on with you could not be cured. But you're sitting here talking to us this morning. You're cured. So obviously something changed. Was it this idea of an integrated, personal, inside-out pain approach, totally different, that made the difference?
Yeah. Yes. Everything you just said. Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Hold it there. We're at the top of the hour now. Just a little before 2 o'clock, 2 a.m. here in the Land of Enchantment. My guest this morning is Peter Bedard. We're talking about his personal transformation from a terrible accident to someone who can actually avail himself of the abilities to ameliorate and control and identify and eliminate pain. We'll talk about that on the other side. This is Bobby Bright, all the way from Australia. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
Things I've done here, simple things confuse me when they ought to be clear. It ain't appealing, it's feeling. Paying for my younger days. Well, I'm paying through the nose for the good times I had in my youth.
And we are back. My guest this morning, Peter Bedard. Peter, I mean, you should not be alive because of not the trauma of dying, but all the awful things that happened afterwards. But you turned it around. You created this concept called convergence healing. Let's start there now. What is convergence healing, and how can we reach out and help an awful lot of people that need help tonight because of the experience that they can see you were able to get on top of things?
Convergence healing really did grow out of all of that pain, that rejection that I felt in the world. And it really became that process for me of having to heal myself when no one else could.
Okay. And that was a don't tap your mic, please. It's causing all kinds of noises in my headphones.
Oh, I'm so sorry about that. I'm just sitting here, so
it's okay. It happens unconsciously.
Right. So when one of the big things that really came in for me was an understanding that I couldn't always go to people to heal me with the expectation that they had to do the work. I had to start taking responsibility for myself and say, hey, this is my life, my breath, my body. And I encourage people to do that. And I really give the understanding that, you know, if I kept living in that experience of blaming the person that killed me, whoever that was, we never found out who that was, but if I kept living in that victim mode of look what they did, they took away my career, my understanding, my way of expressing myself in the world, my voice, they took all of those things away from me. If I would have kept living in that experience, then I would never heal. And so one of the big things I ask people to do, and it seems pretty obvious, and yet we seem to have a resistance to doing it, is to step into that position of it's my life, my breath, my body. I'm in charge. This is the way I'm choosing to live. Instead of being the victim to the things that have happened to me, I am actually going to be the captain and navigate through these experiences.
So a key part of this is you have to own it.
Exactly. Absolutely. And you have to really be willing to step into that experience of owning it where you can't blame and live in that victim state anymore.
Okay.
And so, I call that stepping out of the fog. It's a whole combination of stuff, and it goes even deeper than that. But that's the primary idea. And then once you own it, as you say, I love that, once you own it, then you can really start calling the shots and start exploring the things that you need to do in order to heal. And that's when you have to develop that relationship with the part of you that is hurting.
It's one thing to stop pain, but Peter, you're saying you actually heal several physical problems.
Yep.
This is really important. So focus on that. What was the list of things that was wrong, and what did you do to make it right, and how did the doctors explain it away?
So the doctors always let's start there. The doctors always explain it away by saying, "Oh, well, you know, spontaneous
remission,
or we misdiagnosed, or that type of thing."
Mm-hmm.
But I had fibromyalgia and arthritis and asthma and bronchitis and sciatica. I had severe anxiety and depression, and those are the main things that I was able to heal. Like I grew my
cartilage. And that was only on Thursdays.
What was that?
That was only on Thursdays.
Yeah, right. I wish, then I would have 6 days of good. So I was a walking mess. The next step, once you really take that experience of stepping into your strength and your power and owning who you are in the world, the next step is to actually name your pain. Give it that, start that relationship with it, make it your best friend, name it, develop that new relationship with it, redefine the boundaries around that pain.
You realize a lot of people are saying, they shake their heads at their device, come on, this guy, you can't do it. Tell them how you did it.
So I did it by stuff that I've already sort of alluded to, where I started changing my mental way of addressing the pain. That was the biggest thing, where I stepped into my ability to say, hey, this is my life, I'm calling the shots now. Then managing the pain in a way of developing a relationship that was loving towards it. Then I started asking the pain what it needed to heal. So most of us do the opposite. If your pain is a 17-year-old kid that's really messing up, let's say, everybody is telling him or her what they need to do to fix things. The principal of their school, their parents, their friends, family members are all pointing their finger at them and saying, you need to do this. When nobody's bothered to ask the kid what the kid needs in order to heal. And so using that understanding, I started to ask my pain, all right, now I have a relationship with you. Now you're being affected by this love that I'm sending you. How would you like to heal? Because I can just figure things out or try to, but that's me telling you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you were the personification of my pain, Richard, and instead of my saying, you have to go this, this, and this, do those things, what if I actually came to you and sat down and just listened, and I said, all right, Richard, what's your next move? What do you need in order to feel better? And there's three basic questions that you would ask the part of you that's in pain. You would say, all right, Richard, what can I do to help you feel better on the body physical level? What can I do in the world that's going to bring you closer to your healing? And then the same question on the mind level, because the way we think often creates or continues or perpetuates our pain. So the way we think needs to be adjusted. So I might say to you, Richard, what can I think about? What can I do with my mind, with my thoughts, that's going to help you feel better? Do you want to learn something? Do you want to discipline your thoughts? Do you want to have no thought, like in a meditative state? What do you want to do? What's going to help you? And the same on the level of spirit. What can I do that's going to help you feel better on that level of connecting with the universe, with oneness, whatever it is, whatever your understanding? To listen for the answers. So let me give you an example of something that happened to me. When I was a kid and in that accident, one of the expert doctors told me that I would probably never be able to walk again. And if I could walk again, it was going to be very difficult. And I'd probably have to have my knee replaced by the time I was 40. So maybe a few years roll by and I'm 39 and a half and I'm walking from my garage to my front door and my knee goes pop.
Hmm.
And it's so loud that I could actually hear it outside of my body.
This is the knee that was damaged.
Exactly. And I had done tons of work by that point to have it feel good and be well. And it was pretty good. And so all of a sudden, out of the blue, this knee that was actually in really good shape suddenly swelled up to the size of a football. And I couldn't put any weight on my leg. I could barely walk. I went to the doctors, of course, to see what they would say about it. And they told me that we probably need to do surgery. and I would probably be a candidate for knee replacement, and I shouldn't walk. Now, I got their diagnosis, and I looked at the x-rays, and I understood what was going on according to their diagnostic tools. And instead of jumping into that right away, I delayed it, the surgery or that type of thing, and I started talking to my knee. So instead of talking at it and being angry with it, which was my impulse in the beginning, you know, I'd be so frustrated. I'd done so much to help you heal, and now you're doing this, right? Instead of doing that, I just sat back, and I just put my hands on my knee, and I started towards it.
Oh, wait, we lost you there. Skype skipped.
Sure. I said, I just put my hands gently on my knee, and instead of being abusive to it, I just put my hands on it and started to massage my knee and send it loving thoughts.
This almost sounds, Peter, this almost sounds like some kind of frequency modulation or change.
Sure. It absolutely is, because it's affecting the way we think about and the way we feel about ourselves. So, yeah, it is a frequency change. Now, it gets a little more physical, because I started to ask it those three questions. And I said, what do you need in order to feel better? What can I do physically in the world? Now, the doctors were telling me not to walk, but the impulse, sort of the imagery that kept popping into my mind, into my thoughts, were experiences of walking. So my knee clearly wanted me to move. And yet it was almost impossible to do that. But I decided to do it. I decided to just gimp around, put in weight on my knee as I could, and to walk.
Wasn't that excruciating?
It was very excruciating. But it felt in my body, in the energy of my body, it felt like the right thing to be doing. And so then I started talking to my knee on another level, and I said, what do you need on that level of thinking? Now, my mind had been hijacked by this supposed doctor expert who had told me and predicted my life. And even though, and I was in a trauma mode when this was said to me, because this was said right after the accident, I was in survival mode. I was in a deep amount of pain.
Are we talking about the death experience or the knee problem?
We're talking about the experience of being in the hospital after the death experience doctors are looking at my knee and they're saying we need to do surgery on it.
I see. Okay.
And they were telling me that I would probably not be able to walk, and if I could, it would be very difficult, and I'd have to have my knee replaced by the time I was 40. Mm-hmm. And so all of that...
So you think that might have programmed you?
Oh, absolutely.
Interesting.
...to have any problems at this point.
Wow, that's pretty... You were in such a, I won't say vegetative because that's not accurate, you were in such a malleable, a pliable state that an authority figure, a doctor, says you're going to have that knee replaced in 15 years, and bingo, almost like on a clock, your body says, oh, it's time. He said it's time, and bingo, there you are. Is that what you're saying?
And yeah, absolutely. Wow. And that happened. That's extremely, it's a very common phenomena. Where it's a hypnotic suggestion, where somebody is telling you, it's like somebody saying to a kid when the kid is little, you can go two different directions. Somebody says to the kid, you know, you're an idiot and you're never going to amount to anything, and the kid ends up believing that. Or somebody says to the kid, you're amazing and you're going to go amazing places.
So you're saying that in a traumatized state, when you're incredibly defenseless and you've been traumatized physically, you're traumatized emotionally, spiritually, in every possible way. If people that you believe in, authority figures, tell you certain things, that can have this almost deep hypnotic programming effect to where your body will at some point try to make what they said come true.
Exactly.
Wow.
And it's actually, there's a lot of science behind this. One of my mentors... Her name is Judith Simon Prager, and she works with Cedars and different emergency first responders. And in the past, the first responders would try and make light of a situation.
Oh, so they're doing all that talking and that bullshitting. I guess we can't say that on the air, but they just did. So that is basically not what they should be doing, because they're unconsciously programming the victim's situation.
Unconscious, yeah.
Wow.
And so in the case of these EMTs, they used to go to somebody who had just been in buddy, you don't have to die now. We're here, right? They would think they would be bringing levity and fun to it. But what they're actually saying to the unconscious brain, because their unconscious doesn't necessarily understand don't. It doesn't understand negatives. Mm-hmm. So what the brain actually hears in these trauma states is, hey, buddy, you can die on us. Wow. So instead of don't die, they...
Oh, how interesting.
What they found is when these EMTs go up to people and say, hey, buddy, you could stop bleeding now. The people actually stop bleeding.
What? That kind of conscious control?
Yeah, and it's subconscious.
Now, who's doing this, and where are they practicing this? Where did this develop? These observations.
Well, you can look up. This is through Cedars. You can look up one of my mentors. Her name is Judith Simon Prager. She's had some really interesting books on this.
Okay.
And she's amazing. But that's also why in surgery, they ask doctors not to speak or not to say certain things, because even though that person is under anesthesia, there's something in our consciousness that can hear what's going on.
Well, when people are in comas, standard practice is to simply keep talking and talking and talking, and eventually the theory is they will come back, because we do hear when we're unconscious at some other level. So you're saying there's an actual hospital in California that has taken this modality seriously and is now telling its personnel, don't say those stupid things because they can hear you and you're going to program them.
Exactly. And their body is going to, especially in a trauma mode, the body is going to respond to those outside influences.
That's fascinating.
So, yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating that there is such intelligence on the part of these staffs that they actually can change their behavior in light of new information.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This has been going on for quite a long time, and it's not just at Cedars-Sinai. There's a lot of research on this about how to speak to people in ways that are appropriate in trauma situations.
Interesting.
So my trauma situation, right? And this is part of the problem when you have doctors say things to people about, you know, whether it's a diagnosis of cancer or something else, where they make these statements when people are in these traumatized experiences, and these experiences tend to play out the statements that they say because the subconscious takes it in. And so I had to recognize how my subconscious had taken in that statement, and how my thinking was in this, you know, panic mode of how am I going to do this? How am I going to get through this? How am I ever going to be able to walk again? I'm too young to be able to have my knee replaced. I don't want to be in that amount of pain. I don't want to have that surgery. You know, how am I going to, there's this constant chatter in my mind. And so when I started to address the pain itself and say, hey, what do you want me to think about? Instead, what do you want me to do? Because the way I'm thinking isn't helping the problem. The way I'm thinking is actually continuing that abusive programming.
Right.
And so my mind told me that the pain told me that I needed to discipline my thoughts, that I had to learn how to control my thinking. And that I didn't know what to do with. But as I sat with
Well, that's the most difficult thing of all. It's like if I tell you right now, don't think about pink elephants.
I love
now,
that.
Now, don't think about you're thinking about a pink elephant. You see that pink elephant dancing across the floor. Stop thinking. In other words, how do you consciously stop that process?
So you can't stop the process of thinking about that pink elephant when it comes in. So I didn't necessarily have to stop the process of, oh, there's the doctor telling me what he told me. But what if I started giving it less weight? And what if I started putting more of my attention on something else? So I call this little act positive denial. It's the experience that I developed around working with my cancer clients, where they're constantly being told information. They're always having blood work done. They're always having people interpret their test results. You have one doctor, then another doctor, then their friends and family members and other people who have gone through these things are all telling them information. And I ask my cancer clients to be aware of that, to take what they need, and then to take the rest and just put it in the corner. So it's not a denial out of ignorance. It's a denial out of I'm going to put my energy and my thoughts someplace else. So I had to learn how to become aware of that pink elephant and then say, oh, great, there's a pink elephant. I'm going to put the pink elephant over there in the corner, and I'm going to think about purple zebras instead.
Hmm.
And I'm going to put the majority. So instead of being hijacked by that, old panic opinion and judgment or opinion, which was, say, 100%, suddenly it would drop down to 80%. Mm-hmm. And what if it switched so that I only had 20% of my thoughts and my energy on that old opinion and judgment, but 80% of my thoughts and my life force energy was put on something else? And that started to really switch things around.
Now, you said, I'm sorry to interrupt, you said that addiction and anxiety, that anxiety is kind of like every anxiety has a trauma that lies beneath it, like some kind of a ghost. Can you kind of expand on that?
Sure. So I look at these experiences that drive addiction and anxiety, and they mainly are, anxiety is a coping tool to handle something that your body hasn't been able to handle. It's a way of trying to get through something that's stuck inside you. And the same goes with addiction. Addiction is always, there's something stuck that doesn't feel good, that doesn't feel right, that's a pain experience that we then have to medicate. And we're medicating through drugs or alcohol or what other addictions there are out there. Pretty much anything could be an addiction. Mm. And so these traumas are what we have to really focus on. And so the trauma, it's my definition of trauma, is that trauma is a ghost. It's a memory. It's something from your past. It's not existing in this moment, although you feel it and you think it's happening right now. It's actually a ghost. So it's the something that's happening in your past, and like a ghost, we need to find it.
Sorry, we missed that. It skipped.
Sure. We need to find these traumas and act and notice them like a ghost that isn't from this moment in time, and teach it to find its way back in history.
Oh.
So traumas get stuck in us. As an example, I once worked with a woman who had been sexually abused as a youngster. And she had done a lot of work around this issue in her head. She had done a lot of reasoning and rationalizing and understanding that the person who abused her, and why he abused her, and all that type of stuff. And she'd even done a lot of heart work around that and forgiving the person that abused her. But when her husband came up to her and caressed her, she immediately would freeze up. And so the trauma was still living inside of her. It was that part that without her thinking, without her feeling, just immediately kind of her body just tensed up and froze.
Mm.
And so that right there is the ghost. There's nothing in the moment, in that experience with her loving husband, caressing her lovingly, that is causing that experience of her flinching. And so trauma often bullies our head. We can talk about an experience for a long time, but if it's stuck inside of us, it's going to bully our rationale. And it also bullies the heart. So my addict, bringing it back to my addict, if my addict's sitting at the bar, it's very common for him or her to have that conversation. They're on their 10th drink, and their head is saying, hey, you don't really need this drink. And their heart is saying, please don't have that drink. Please don't have it. But the trauma is so strong inside them that it's going to overrule, it's going to bully those experiences. And the drink is going to be something that's needed in order flee, freeze, or hide. So that drink is a way to fight off. The drink is a way to flee and run away. The drink is a way to just numb out and not feel it, or hide from an experience in which you can't see me, I can't see you. So we have to get through these traumas. And so that was part of the, that's another part, another component of this convergence healing. Working on this on one end, actually befriending the pain, talking to it, getting to know it, loving it and asking what it needs to heal. And on the other hand, dealing with these traumatic experiences that get stuck inside of us, processing them through us so that they can be released, so they no longer are dictating or controlling our behavior and bullying our conscious mind and our hearts.
So you developed like what, a 10-point process for doing this methodically?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a very simple, basic little process. It's very simple and straightforward, but it takes time. It takes effort because, as you know, the mind can easily get hijacked by things. So it takes effort. I always say five times the effort to actually continue the work, to say, okay, great, my mind just got hijacked. I just went into that pain thinking. Can I think about something else? And so it becomes, there's a learning curve to it.
So let's go through the 10 points.
Sure. I've already laid out a couple of them, but the primary is to step out of the fog and then to name your pain, to befriend your disease, to start loving it, to develop that relationship with it and ask it those questions of what do you need in order to heal? What does it need on the body level, mind level, and spirit level? And then to really to look at the ghost of the trauma, to work through that trauma, and then to really start understanding your life as who you are without your pain. So what is it like for yourself to live in the world without that experience anymore? So for me, I was trapped in that constant experience of the pain of that accident, right? Mm-hmm. And like I said before, when I first started talking about the accident, where I started to recognize that the energy of thought moves far faster than the energy of the physical world.
Yes.
And so when we can start thinking in a way of at understanding who we are without the pain, it takes time, but the body will begin to catch up. So if your body starts to understand on a very deep level, who are you without the pain? What is it like to walk through the world without that pain? What does it sound like in your voice? What does it feel like in your bones? And the understanding of that, then all of a sudden the body has to go, oh, wait, huh? We're not in that state anymore. And there's part of that energetic shift that you brought up earlier of, oh, okay, now I need to catch up. Hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. And I said not energy, I said frequency. See, frequency, people talk about energy medicine. Mm-hmm. Frequency is so much more important than the energy, because the energy we're talking about is really, 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 really tiny. You know, on a scale of the world, it's trivial.
Yeah.
But it's huge to us, and it's more the frequency. It's the programming. It's the undoing the other programming. So that's what I'd like you to kind of really get inside of. How can people who are trapped in their anxieties, in their traumas, in their – I mean, that's why people drink. I understand you have said at some point that the concept that once an addict, always an addict is a lie. Is that because we can reprogram ourselves to not be addictive?
Exactly. There's a plasticity to the brain. And so when the brain starts to understand itself in a different way other than being hijacked by the experience of the addiction, then the healing can really happen. So it's a powerful experience just to understand who you are without that. And that phrase, once an addict, always the addict, is it really pigeonholes people into where the mind and the brain are sort of intertwined with each other, where the mind and the brain are actually separate things coexisting with each other. When we're in addiction, especially in addiction, and even experiences of overwhelming pain, the mind only can understand itself as part of the brain, and the brain is just habitual responses. Mm. And so when the brain can be reprogrammed, and the mind is the part that steps out of the brain and says, whoa, wait, there are other possibilities in the world. You begin to change the physical form. And so it starts with your – it's one of the ways it starts is with your thinking. I once had a person who I was dealing with who was had a severe drinking addiction, and he only could understand himself in the world as that person with that addiction.
That's terrible.
Himself as someone without the addiction, just understanding himself just as who he was, as the truth of who he is. And then the addiction started to break away. And so suddenly he didn't need to see himself in that particular way anymore. So the habituated responses of the brain. And the habituated responses are really easy to see. You know, there's a part of us that we call the critical mind, and the critical mind is the part that will do anything it possibly can in order to get you to stay in your pain as it is. Hmm. So the job description of the critical mind is to keep you safe, comfortable, and familiar. That's the absolute job description. And so let's take something as simple as quitting smoking.
Well, hang on. We can take quitting smoking after the bottom of the hour. We're at 2:30 here in the Land of Enchantment. My guest this morning is Peter Bedard, and we're talking basically about how we can get rid of pain from the inside out. Amazing. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight in this frosty pre-dawn. It's actually pretty warm tonight here in the Land of Enchantment. It's all the way up to 40 degrees, actually, maybe even 39. Anyway, Peter, a lot of people are going to be very skeptical, obviously, because we live in a skeptical age. I presume that as part of your counseling and dealing with clients and patients, that when they ask, or if they ask for your own medical records so they you can show them that you did this yourself, those are available. People can actually see an objective record of what you have done to fix yourself.
Well, nobody's ever asked for that, but I do have x-rays, so I could always pull those out.
Okay.
But you're the first person who's ever even brought it up.
Well, that's my science back. You know, a lot of people think this is all crackpot stuff, but since we know there's a physics that allows this to work, I'm interested in actually the hands-on, how does it work? So this is now, we got about half an hour. There have been people who've been calling randomly during the show, and I have not been answering because obviously I wanted you to be able to lay foundation and tell your story. If people want to talk to you, I think now would be a good time.
Great.
You can connect with us on Skype. Obviously, our Enterprise Mission Skype handle works. And if I can find our phone number somewhere hiding around here... it is 505-796-8802. Look, when you deal with people who have real trauma, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of pain, and there's an awful lot of people that doctors are not prescribing enough pain medication for some reason. I talked with Robin about that some years ago, and I don't understand why doctors would withhold, you know, medications that patients think they need. But you bring this approach, which is they don't need drugs at all, provided they do what?
So, just to clarify, I'm not anti-Western medicine. I'm not a big fan of drugs and surgeries unless they're really needed, and I think we overdo those. So, but I'm not against that. Okay. The main thing is that I ask people to get in touch with the part of them that hurts, to love that part, to begin this dialogue with it, and to let the part actually guide them on their own prescription for healing.
How did you grow your leg back to normal size? That's one of the things that I find so hard to believe about this, that you actually from inside your own body took control of the mechanisms that function, cell division and all that, and you regrew your knee.
So I don't know if I took control of the... My leg was shorter because of the surgery.
Right.
And because I was missing cartilage in my leg. And so what I was able to do was the connective tissue, all of that white sort of connective tissue. Why am I losing the word on it? It's not muscles. It is fibers.
It's because the middle of the night. That's why you're losing the
word. Yeah, that's true. It is way past my bedtime.
You're not talking collagen, are you?
No. I'm talking the connective tissue that connects the muscles to the bone.
Okay.
Anyway, so it's the connective
ligaments?
Tissue.
Ligaments?
Ligaments is part of it. Fascial tissue.
Fascial tissue, okay.
So I started doing – my fascial tissue had become brittle, and it had become very immobile due to my not being able to move as well as I could, and the lack of blood flow through those areas. So I started doing Rolfing work, which actually was able to bring the blood back to the fascial tissue.
So this is deep tissue massage.
It's of the muscles. It's of the fascial tissue.
Okay.
So it's very different than traditional massage. But I started doing this myofascial type of massage, and it's called Rolfing or structural integration. I combined that. Remember, we have to heal on all levels. So I combined that with something called prolotherapy. Prolotherapy allowed me to grow my cartilage back. Now, prolotherapy has been around since the 1920s, and I did it with a doctor at UCLA. But most medical doctors don't know anything about it, and they poo-poo it. What prolotherapy did was it's a sugar shot. They injected dextrose either into the cavity of the knee or any other joint cavity, mm-hmm. into the ligaments or cartilage. It creates a acute inflammation. The body responds to the inflammation by growing collagen. Collagen is the building block for ligaments, tendons, and cartilage. So I actually was able to grow my cartilage back in my knee. And at the same time, I was always also doing all this myofascial work, which actually brought blood flow back into my leg. The fascial tissue loosened up, and I was able to get my knee back into a point where now my legs are the same length instead of one being shorter than the other.
Wow.
Now, I also had to work in that work, especially with the Rolfing type of work. Rolfing, in its traditional form, is extremely painful. It's something we did as a ballet dancer where they dig so deep into the tissue, you're wanting to deck somebody. That Rolfing work that I did was what I was able to trigger that memory to come back into my consciousness as well, so that my leg that was trapped in that experience, even frozen in time, in that emotional experience of the trauma of the accident, the Rolfing released that. And so the emotional memory that was in my body was also able to go. So literally my leg unfroze and was able to find its. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Now, the only problem I have is you're doing this to yourself, but how do you export this technique to a lot of other people? Because to get people to take control of their own lives is probably the most difficult thing you can imagine.
Yeah, it can be. But the people that come to me tend to be very willing because they've already been through the ringer.
Basically at their last hope.
Yeah, and that's changing. When I first started doing this work, I got the people that the doctor said they didn't know what to do with anymore. And now I get people that are basically saying, hey, you know, I know what the doctors want to do. I'm not exactly in alignment with that, and I want to see if there's something else. And so that's when I said it's not about saying that you can't have the surgery. It's about letting the pain itself say, is that in alignment with what they're really looking for? And so sometimes allopathic medicine will be part of their solution, and sometimes it won't be. It's about developing an individuated plan per person on how to create the healing.
Now, a lot of people, I mean, most people don't go through physical traumatic situations like you did. Most of the pains in our society are more psychological. Like, for instance, how do you deal with alcoholism?
So alcoholism is that way of really understanding, as of any addiction, what is the thing that is hurting so much that this person needs to medicate it. And so it's about going into that trauma, to whatever that experience was, and unfreezing it. Now, the nice thing about the way that I do this, and I've done this work with, say, our veterans, with some soldiers. So they come back extremely traumatized, and quite frankly, I don't want to know what their traumatizing experience was. I don't want to know the violence they had to go through. I don't want to understand that story, and traditional psychotherapy is oftentimes about getting into that story.
Exactly.
And I'm not about that at all. I let them have that experience, and what we do is we hold space for the actual physical experience and how it's stuck in the body. It's very somatic. So it's really about saying, okay, let's go back to the example I gave earlier with the woman who was freezing up.
Mm-hmm.
So we would go back to that experience, and instead of reliving that experience, which only makes think of the groove in the brain, the neural pathway of the brain, deeper. Instead of doing that, we actually hold space for how that experience has been living inside your body or her body. So our minds know the world through our senses. And although we often don't recognize that there's a temperature, a texture, a color, a smell, a sound, or even a taste to a trauma, to an experience, the brain does. And so I would ask my addicts, let's say, what it's like, what it feels like, what is the temperature, texture, color, sound, smell, taste of their misery, of the addiction. And then we can actually go in and start creating new experiences that challenge those old ghosts. So back to my woman, her experience, she may feel a freezing up in her, in let's say her lower abdomen, her gut. It may be heavy, it may be sharp and stabbing, it may be hot, it may be red, and there may even be a smell to it or a taste. I know I used to get the taste quite often when I would go into my traumas of that sort of metallic sucking on a quarter. And now that's how the brain understood these experiences. And so we go in and we teach these ghosts, because like say if my woman that was sexually abused, if she's sitting in front of me and we're in a session, obviously she's not being sexually abused in that moment. It's the ghost. Mm-hmm. So I ask her to hold space for that experience. Now she may feel it. Her body may tremble. She may be really upset. She may flush. She may get a panic or a fear come over her. And I'll ask her just to sit with that experience, not the story that she's made up or that she has about the experience, but actually just hold space and sitting with and being with that physical experience. Mm-hmm. And that's when I appeal to the conscious brain as well. And I say, now you do understand you're sitting across from me. You're in this very loving place. And there's that none of that abuse is happening right now. And she'll say, yes. And it's that thing from the past that suddenly or somehow got stuck inside of you. So let's teach that ghost to find its way back in history. Hmm. So then we go into the actual mind and how the mind knows this experience. I bring in a phrase that was taught to me by Qigong master, and the phrase is already done, because the truth is, as our conscious brain recognized, that experience isn't happening in this moment.
So you're dealing with the pain almost like an alien conscious entity that has basically attached itself like a vampire to
that's a good way to put it. Sure. I never thought of it as an alien thing, because I always think of it as part of you, but it certainly is from an outside source. It's certainly something that has been stuck inside you.
Fascinating. Okay, we've got Stephen who wants to join the conversation. Good morning, Stephen. You're on
the air. Good morning.
Stephen, little loud, go ahead. Go on.
I really enjoyed your topic, Mike, your guest. I was kind of wondering, as a military veteran who does suffer PTSD, has he ever thought of maybe going to work for a VA or finding out if he could work with patients suffering from TBIs or PTSD?
Yeah, Stephen, I'm going to have to cut you off because your mic's very bad, but you basically want to know if he's working with military veterans who suffer from PTSD, right?
Correct. Or if he's ever thought about doing that.
Okay, I believe he does. Peter?
I actually do work with veterans, and I would like to work more. Unfortunately, with the VA, a lot of the work they do with mental health is all pharmaceutical-based, so it's a psychiatrist.
Well, that's most of what psychiatrists do. I mean, I know someone who just went to a psychiatrist, and all they do is give them pills.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what they do with the VA. There are of different practitioners at the VA doing a type of work called EMDR, which is called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And it's a very effective. It's not as effective as the work that I've been doing from my experience, because I do have people that come to me who've done that. But you can get EMDR done through some VA centers. I would love to work at a VA and even volunteer at my local VA. If you know anybody, if you're still listening, or if anybody listening has any contacts with
Believe me, Peter, this show has such reach and such connections. I would not be surprised if you get a phone call in the next couple of days and someone wants to come and work with you, because what you're describing is amazing. But since we have you to prove that it works, it's only amazing because we don't know how to do it ourselves yet. Let's ask this person. Good morning. You're on the air. What would you like to ask Peter?
Good morning. I just wanted to tell Peter, I love you, man. I do the same thing that you do. And Richard and the rest of the audience, this is all real. And Richard, you keep surprising me on your grasp of so many subjects. because how Peter and I do this, and I had a near-death experience too, but I've had this gift since I was 4 years old. It was very hard growing up when you touch someone and all their pain would go away, but I would get their pain.
But that's not a good deal.
The pain is of everything in the universe is a frequency which makes a vibration, which makes an energy.
Right.
So when you said the vampire thing, it is Peter and I actually, he does it different. I do it through colors. But I visualize colors and I push that person's pain out. And I do it with love, with the help of God. And Peter goes deeper into the person's pain. He doesn't need the details, but he still does it the same way. But I just wanted to validate that Peter's real. And it's such a blessing helping people. People don't know how hard it is, and they don't know how hard Peter has to, how weak he is when he helps someone, how weak I am. But it's such love, and each time you do it, you build up and you build up more brownie points. And when I went to heaven, everyone was clapping, and I'll get away from Peter's soapbox. But Peter, I just wanted to say you're real, especially since that other caller. And Richard, you are the man. Frequency, vibration, and an energy. That's how you push pain out.
Well, thank you. Peter, any response?
That's awesome. Love you, man. I appreciate it. We need more people stepping into that position. So I'm glad you're doing it.
Well, as soon as I finish my book that I've only been working on 40 years, because I've always had self-doubt, and I never believed that I helped the people with pain. And I've worked with over 20,000 people, but I just want to send you love and tell more people they have to listen to Richard C. Hoagland, because he gets it. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's a vampire or some crazy guy that has something with mold. When he gets done riding his truck, he gets it. God bless.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
Peter, we only got a few minutes left. I want to turn the conversation slightly to something a little more encompassing. We've tried certain experiments on this show, consciousness experiments, particularly with President Jimmy Carter and his cancer. Is it your feeling that if people can actually visualize and become one-on-one with the problems they have, that they literally can do this from the inside out, and it doesn't take, you know, a village, it doesn't take 1,000 people, it doesn't take 10,000, it just takes you wanting it to really change?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that want has to become something physicalized, because there's plenty of people that want to change, but they don't have the ability or they don't bring it into the world. So it's got to take on a physical form. It has to move from just that thought frequency into energy and into physicality. It has to have that understanding. Because wanting to change only goes so far.
Well, your 10-step program obviously brings a rigor to this that normally most people wouldn't have.
Exactly. And it's a way to do it that is, it actually becomes fun and loving, and it's about building relationship and expanding instead of contracting and hurting.
Hmm. So what about applying this to other – I mean, we've gone through alcohol addiction. We've gone through physical trauma. There's an awful lot of pain on this planet, an incredible amount of pain, and you're saying that a lot of it can be alleviated if we basically own it and then work with it.
Exactly, by embracing it. I was talking to a friend of mine who does a lot of work in post-traumatic growth and that understanding of how we bonded, because we both have this understanding of how traumatic and painful experiences can actually make us bigger and better people. And she has a book that she wrote all about that in her research. And we were actually talking about how to apply these types of things on a global level. Instead of creating the enemy, what if we actually embrace the enemy?
Mm.
What if we, you know, because we create these little wars inside of us. And if as above, so below, you know, as within, so without, if that is an absolute truth, which I think it is, what would it be like to take this work and this understanding to a global level? To, you know, instead of hating these parts of us on the planet that are in pain, what if we actually embraced and loved them and actually asked them what they needed to heal? So instead of going in and telling them what they need, what if we actually asked the people what they needed in order to make a better life for themselves?
You know, you raise a really interesting situation. There's a lot of discussion now that ISIS is recruiting, from various millennial or younger populations that are so unhappy, so disenchanted, so out of place in their lives that they're willing to imagine going to a foreign land and involve themselves in some kind of ancient, assassin or Templar or Middle Eastern tradition to put meaning back in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible? I mean, there's a lot of discussion that the way we confront this is not militarily, not with force, not with killing all the terrorists, because you literally can't kill all the terrorists, because every new generation is going to bring a whole new group of people who are out of place, out of time, out of themselves, and who basically are just time bombs, walking time bombs, waiting to be, you know, crystallized or catalyzed or triggered or whatever. Would your modality work in a social media context where instead of directing hate at these people, we somehow share love?
That I think so. I'm not sure how to apply that. I'm not sure how to bring it into the world, but I truly...
Well, healing is healing.
Exactly.
They're obviously in pain, in terrible pain.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and they're not getting any of their needs met, just like that part of, like when I use the example of you being my pain, that part is not getting any of its needs met. It's not even being heard or recognized or witnessed. And so when you stop and just give that recognition, that love, when you witness other people's pain, even if it's your own, something miraculous happens. You know, there's that, I give the example of a friend coming to you and just crying and, you know, gnashing and, you know, beating or whatever they're doing. And, you know, an hour later, when you hold space for them, suddenly they sort of emerge from that pain and they say, oh, thank you so much. I feel so much better. And all you did is allow them to express.
So it's the expression of the pain that is a crucial part of the healing process.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Letting it be heard.
Okay, so if we combine these two ideas... Mm-hmm. Distance healing, you know, we're all connected in the field. That's how this works. If it works at all, that's how it works. So we're connected in the field. So using the Peter Bedard principle, what if we directed love at ISIS as opposed to the hate that everybody else is now purveying?
That's what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. And build a relationship with this part instead of bombing it or wanting to, like I say, they're the part that's in pain. Why? Instead of cutting it out, throwing it away, making it wrong, bad, punishing it, any of that kind of stuff. What if we just turned around and loved it? And I see little miracles every day when people start these types of things.
Well, the good are getting better and the bad are getting worse and the physics is underlying all of it. So how can people reach you if they have a personal situation or they want to talk to you about maybe getting involved with the VA or anything? How do they reach Peter?
Sure. And you've been so great about putting those links up on your site. I do appreciate that. They can go to convergencehealing.com and they could sign up for my newsletter. They could find me under Convergence Healing on Instagram as well as on Facebook. And you can message me through all of those resources.
Wow. Okay, got a couple of minutes. Final thoughts?
I'm hoping that people in listening to this will start sort of looking at their experiences, because a lot of people up at this time of night are in pain.
Hmm.
And they'll start actually saying to themselves, well, can I connect with this part of me that's hurting in a different way? And can it be a loving way? Can I even name it and allow it to be my friend? And can I just start listening to it, asking it what it needs in order to feel better. And then developing that plan, developing that say, okay, what does it need? It needs to physically, on the body level, go run in the grass or hug a tree. On the mind level, it needs to think about something else even if it's just watching crazy, stupid cat videos, because that stops the brain from being in that obsessive pain thought.
Oh, cat and videos are tremendous for that, yes.
They're awesome.
Particularly if they're kittens. Not cats, but kittens.
Exactly. Yes. And they really do what's called a pattern interrupt, and they break that pattern of abusive thinking. And to ask those three questions, what can they do? What can they do for their pain on that physical level to help it feel better? What can they do for their pain in order to help it feel better on their thoughts, using their thoughts? And what can they do on the level of spirit to create a path, a process, an ingredient, or a recipe for their own individual healing?
Well, Peter, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on The Other Side of Midnight. I believe this physics has all kinds of applications and healing, personal healing, because as you said, a lot of people are up at night because they're in pain. If you want to give people one prescription for transferring that pain, what would it be as we leave and the music quietly begins to play?
Send it as much love as you possibly can and connect with that love on all levels of your brain, whether it's a color of that love, a temperature of that love, a smell or a taste, or even a texture of that love. Wrap that pain in that love and it will respond to you.
Peter, thank you so much. My guest this morning, Peter Bedard, we've been talking about healing. We'll come back to this in the future. So until tomorrow morning, same time, same bat channel, and it's open hailing frequencies tomorrow with surprises. Remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning.